That's not the title. Well, yeah, it is the title. Yeah, no, it is. It's part of the title. Seven at the Golden Shovel. All right, so let me just say something about your papers, which are due a week from today. everyone looks grim. So what I'm going to do, I haven't sent it out yet, but what I'm going to do is send you a sheaf of poems that, again, you can pick one to write from. So that'll go out through Latte. Just to make clear what maybe wasn't clear enough is send your papers to me via email. Do not submit them on Latte, because Latte is the worst thing ever invented. Send them to me by email, and send them as a dot doc or a Google doc or something that it's easy for me to comment on. So I know you all know this from the first papers, but sometimes memories are short, I have noticed in my time. I think there are like five poems, maybe six. You should read through all those poems many times. And in order to encourage you to do that, there is actually a week from today going to be a quiz to make sure you read those poems. So don't just read the first poem or look for the shortest poem or anything like that. Like, who would do that, right? Who would do that? never seen anything like that. So read through all those poems several times, so because there will be a quiz on them after you've read through them several times and thought about them, then pick one to write on. These are all poems in which you're going to be thinking about metaphors, the metaphors in the poem, how they work. Remember that what we've been discussing for the last couple of weeks is metaphor, what metaphors do, and what does metaphor, that is, how it is that poems may be forced into using metaphor. That's one of the issues we've been talking about, and how poems use metaphors to say what, to do, I'm not even going to say, to do what it is that poems want to do. And remember the important fact that every metaphor is false. If you say that something is something that it isn't, then you are saying something that is literally false. That's why we distinguish between the literal and the metaphorical. Metaphors are always literally false. If they're not literally false, they're not metaphors. Yeah.
When will you be sending out those poems?
Later today.
All right.
Yeah.
When will the quiz be and what's the structure?
The quiz will be, so the papers are due a week from today, and the quiz will be a week from today. So you will, before you write your papers, you'll have read the poems many, many times, so that'll be good. Then the quiz will be a week from today when the papers are due. And if your papers are late, which has been known to happen in this class, first time in all my years of Brandeis that people got papers in late. It's never happened to me before. You should still have read through the poems many times, even if by some strange quirk there are late papers, you should have still read through the poems many times. I can send you my poem about plagiarism again if you want, or you can just fucking remember it. But do not do any outside research. It's really tempting to do because, you know, you just want to read the Wikipedia entry on the poet that you're writing about, and then you find out something interesting about the poet that you're writing about. And push comes to shove, to use a metaphor, and suddenly there are ideas that you could have had, you're sure you could have, but that you actually read elsewhere. So don't. I think Lillian and Craig is now asking on the chat what's the format of the quiz. If you've read the poems and if you sort of have a sense of all of them, they're just going to be short answers. It's just to make sure to encourage you to a certain familiarity with the poem. Yeah.
Will you send like the specifics of the paper with the poems later, like the word count and things like that?
The word count's the same. They're all three the same. Okay. And the specifics are just what I'm saying. Talk about metaphor the way we're talking about metaphor. Talk about what metaphors are doing and how poems are doing metaphors, what metaphors do to a poem, what a poem does to metaphors. All the poems are different in the way they use metaphors. That's one reason that I want you to read them all. It's not like, here are five examples of the apparition of these faces in the crowd. Like the apparition of these faces in the crowd, pebbles in a puddle in the parking lot, or the apparition of these faces in the crowd, people at a soccer game watching Ronaldo. So it's not, they're not all going to be the same. And part of the point here is that the whole set of poems, as well as this Shelley poem that we're going to do today and Thursday, the whole set of poems is going to give you a context for the possibilities of metaphors. I'm going to send them out today. If you have questions, you can bring them up at the beginning of class on Thursday. If on a need-to-know basis, I will tell you what you might need to know. I have written little parenthetical bits of information at the bottom of each poem. So that's why don't go to Wikipedia, because what you might need to know, you don't even need to know it, what you might be curious about. I think in one of them you do need to know it. So there's one of the poems, I actually distributed it the last class, but we didn't get to it. One of the poems is called American Sonnet for My Past and Future Assassin. Do people know of that title or the poet Terence Hayes? All right, so Terence Hayes is a contemporary poet. He won a MacArthur, I think, before this book came out, I think in 2016. And he published a book called American Sonnets, plural, for My Past and Future Assassin. And it consists of, or it comprises, 70 sonnets, all of which have the same title, which is American Sonnet, singular, for My Past and Future Assassin. So that's something it's worth knowing, that you are reading one of 70 sonnets that he wrote with that title. In the title of the book, it's sonnets, plural, but assassin, singular. So American Sonnets for My Past and Future Assassin. Each individual sonnet is American Sonnet for My Past and Future Assassin. It's okay with me as long as it's not too tempting, which it will be, so I'm just gonna say it's not okay with me. Never mind. I was gonna say you could look at some other, okay, if you're interested in some of the other American sonnets in the book for My Past and Future Assassin, let me know. Don't Google them, because you're going to get curious and then you're going to find out information that it's going to be totally harmless for you to find out, except no research. So it's just inevitably going to turn into a little bit of facts and ideas and interpretations that are going to occur to you that would have occurred to you anyhow, but now because you saw them online, you can't use them. Okay? So if you're curious to see others, let me know and I can send you a couple of others. But don't feel that you have to be curious to see others. All you need to know is that the sonnets are standalones, but all 70 of them have the same title, which means that there is a point to them. Also, the fact that it's My Future Assassin, fine, that's not that hard a thought. But Past Assassin means that being assassinated, at least according to the title of the book and of these sonnets, can't be taken literally. If you're assassinated like JFK or almost like Paul Pelosi, then you're not going to write sonnets afterwards, except in some other world. After Shelley died, a book of poems was published in the late 19th century. Shelley, whom we're about to do, died in the early 19th century, but a book of poems was published in the late 19th century. And it turned out that a medium contacted him, and he dictated some poems to her, which she then took down and published. So we found out how Shelley's poetry in the afterlife was like. And it seems that like dying is really bad for you if you're a poet. It destroys your talent. But Terence Hayes's poems are really great. And that means that, at least if we take Shelley as an example, the assassin has to be metaphorical rather than literal, because he's still alive. So that's just something to know about that. Okay, any other questions?
I have one.
Yes.
So for the paper, we're reading all for all the poems?
You're writing about one poem, but you're reading through all the poems.
Okay.
And that will be assessed by the quiz on the poems.
When is the
quiz? A week from today. So that would be election day. So, but it'll be so much more interesting than the election for you, right? Mm-hmm. What? You think the fate of the world is more interesting than some metaphorical poems? Seriously? Seriously? But the world is a poem. See what I did there?
Yes.
Okay. Did you care? No. Okay, so let's put it this way. You won't have to be despairing yet when you take the quiz. You won't be able to say, I cannot take this quiz because of what happened, because it won't have happened yet. Okay? Fair is fair. Gotta be fair. Okay. So the poem you have in front of you is a poem by Percy Bysshe Shelley. As some of you know, married to Mary Shelley, they spent a whole lot of time together thinking about literature, thinking about exile, because they were essentially exiled from England, thinking about the meaning of life, thinking about mortality. Those of you who've read Frankenstein, how many have? There's a scene in Frankenstein that takes place at Mont Blanc, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein that takes place at Mont Blanc, and her husband's poem is also about Mont Blanc. They visited Mont Blanc in 1819, and they were both stunned by it. So Mont Blanc is the tallest mountain in Europe. It is for people who had never seen tall mountains. It is stunning and sublime and overwhelming. And they were stunned and sublimed, or whatever the verb would be, and overwhelmed by it. And as I say, it becomes a really important scene in the novel Frankenstein, where there is lots of poetry that's really important to that novel. Percy Shelley is actually a minor character in Frankenstein. There's a character in Frankenstein based on Percy Shelley. And both Shelleys wrote about their experience of the mountain. And we are reading this poem as a way into thinking about some major aspects of metaphor. So let me just hasten to say one more time that the poems that you can write on all treat metaphor differently from each other. It's not that you should take this as or any version of metaphor as the basic way that metaphor works. There is, as you know, only one truth, but infinite numbers of lies, because metaphors are untrue. In a way, there can't be a single way that metaphor worked, because if there were a single way that metaphor worked, it could just be something you decoded. Like if you have a code which says A equals N, B equals O, C equals P, etc., you know, a very simple alphabetical code, then you could decode it and get a perfectly consistent way of decoding something. If there were a consistent way of decoding metaphors, there'd be no reason for metaphor. So the motives for metaphor, to quote the title of a poem, the motives for metaphor are partly going to be something that the metaphor itself will let you understand. So the reason that something is a metaphor, as we saw when we were looking at Shakespeare's Sonnet 73, the reason for those three metaphors that we were going through is that they were developing. They weren't three versions of the same thing, although at first they appeared to be. That is, it's late, it's late, it's late. That is the crudest interpretation, the crudest way of decoding those metaphors. It's late, it's late, it's late. It's late in life, it's late in life, it's late in life. But it turns out that they weren't parallel to each other. That late in the year turns into later in the day than it was in the year, which then turns into later in the late evening than it was in the day. So the very fact that you have three metaphors that look like they're parallel but turn out not to be has an effect. So don't imagine that metaphors work the same way. Any decent metaphor is going to do something different in some way or other from what other metaphors have done. So part of this is to look closely at the poems and see how the metaphor is specific to that poem, how the metaphor is the poem doing something specific with it. And Mont Blanc is, Percy Shelley's version of Mont Blanc is, like all poems about
poems.
Yes, and in particular itself. And in this case, it's also about the relation of metaphor to human perception of the world. So it's in five parts. We'll start with part one. As I say, I doubt we'll get through it today. It is, to do it properly, you should probably take the rest of the semester. But for you all to do the 9 hours of reading outside of class and have it all be Mont Blanc for 9 hours, that would be a lot of Mont Blanc. So does someone want to read the first stanza? Yeah, go ahead, Alanis.
Of the Shelley one, right?
Yeah, the Shelley.
Okay. The everlasting universe of things flows through the mind and rolls its rapid waves, now dark, now glittering, now reflecting the moon, now lending splendor where from secret springs the source of human thought its tribute brings. Of waters with a sound but half its own, such a feeble brook will oft assume. In the wild woods among the mountains roam, where waterfalls around it leave forever. Where woods and winds contend in a vast river over its rocks, ceaselessly burst and reefs.
Thank you. Okay, so we know the title of the poem is Mont Blanc. We've talked a little bit about when poems started getting titles. But by the time Shelley is writing, by the early 19th century, the default is that poems have titles, and titles will often give you the topic that a poem is about. So the first stanza, how many people have ever seen Mont Blanc? Been there, done that? How many people have seen photos or videos or anything like that of Mont Blanc? Okay, just imagine a sublime mountain. What can I tell you? Glacier on top. At the time that Shelley was writing, and this actually matters, I left out a footnote that Shelley writes to the poem. But by the time we saw footnotes in poems, and that's something worth thinking about. You may have noticed the footnote to Pink Dog has a footnote to it. Fantasia, footnote, carnival costume. So footnotes actually ultimately should not be left out of poems, but anthologists always leave them out. Here it doesn't matter, but what Shelley says in the footnote is something that was true about Mont Blanc in 1819 when he writes this. And at the time, Mont Blanc had just only recently been climbed for the first time. So it's actually may not even have been. It's sometime around then that a human being first climbed to the top of Mont Blanc. Now you can take a cable car to the top and you can have some hot chocolate and look at Swiss people enjoying their hot chocolate and whatever. But at the time, it was completely isolated and lonely. That's why in Frankenstein, the monster, the creature, actually goes rushing away into the glaciers of Mont Blanc, which is an inhuman place. So just imagine, you know, the bleakest rocky mountain you can think of. Don't imagine Everest because, you know, there's trash all over Everest, but imagine what Everest should be. Just the bleakest mountain you can think of. And here this poem is called Mont Blanc. And what is the first stanza about? That Alanis just read. Yeah, okay, good. Yeah.
I was getting more specifically about some, like, I don't know if it's like a river or a stream, but some sort of water.
Yeah.
Specifically.
Yeah. So there is a river there, as he's about to say in the second stanza, called the River Arve, A-R-V-E. And it has its source at Mont Blanc. That is, it's the melting glacier. Yeah, sorry, what I forgot to say about the footnote was at the time the glacier was extending. So now it's receding like all the glaciers in the Alps and in Greenland and in Antarctica, but who cares who wins the election, really. But at the time, glaciers were actually expanding all over the Alps and in lots of different parts of the world. So it's expanding, and it is a really desolate, if that's the right word, or sublime, if that's the right word, place. So, but in the summer when there's some melt off from the glacier, it's a source of a river. You know, this is an issue with the Colorado River now and with how much snowpack there is in the Rockies, and it's all a crisis. But don't worry about voting on Tuesday. But notice that if the poem were not entitled Mont Blanc, what you would get in that first stanza is a philosophical argument or a philosophical position about human perception. So there's the universe of things, and on the other side of the universe of things is what?
Mind.
The mind. So mind and world is what that first stanza seems to be about. So it's fine to remember that the title is Mont Blanc, but provisionally notice that the first stanza is not officially about Mont Blanc. The everlasting universe of things. So what is the everlasting universe of things? What does that phrase mean? This is an easy question. I think.
Everything?
Okay, good. Yes, there's the great philosopher W.V. Quine has an essay called, it's one of his great essays called On What There Is. And he says the really good thing about the ontological question, that is the question about what exists, that's the ontological question, is how easily you can pose it, which is you can simply ask the deepest philosophical question can be posed in three words. What is there? And then he says, and not only that, but it can be answered even more easily in one word. Everything. So what is there? What exists? Everything. Yeah, this is the everlasting universe of things. What isn't everlasting, unlike things?
People.
Yes, us. So there's the everlasting universe of things, and then there's us, which in the second line is represented by the word?
Mind.
Mind. So it's things versus the mind. That's the first issue in the poem. I was going to say the first thing in the poem, but that would be misleading because it's not a thing, it's a relation between things and the mind. So what does it mean to say the everlasting universe of things flows through the mind? Just paraphrase that.
Everything goes through the mind.
Yeah, everything goes through the mind. Or, so is this claim, as Vivi is saying, is this claim that only what goes through the mind exists? Or is the claim rather that what goes through the mind comes from an everlasting exterior? We're here for a little while, for our evil and brief pilgrimage, as the Catechism has it. We're here for a little while. And then there's the everlasting universe of things. So in a way, that's the first question. It's one of the first questions in all of philosophy is which has priority, mind or world? Scientists think they have the answer. The world. Duh. Except for quantum theorists who don't think that's true. But the question, which has priority, world or mind, is a question that goes all the way back to Plato, if not farther. But it certainly goes back to Plato. Would there be a world without a mind? Could there be a mind without a world? So if you believe in evolution, yeah, you need the world for the mind to exist. And the world is there whether there's a mind perceiving it or not. One of the famous early 18th century versions of claiming that the mind is more important is the famous line by Bishop Berkeley. What is it? What were you going to say? To be is to be perceived. Everything that exists only exists because it's perceived. So that's a kind of radical claim to make. But it's also an impossible claim to show is wrong, which is one of the amazing things about it. How are you going to prove it's wrong? You're going to say something like, oh yeah, you think this has to be perceived to exist? To which Berkeley's going to say, what has to be perceived? You know, that thing right in front of you. You mean the thing that I'm looking at right now? So you can never point to something that can't be perceived, because you're pointing to something in order to get someone to perceive it. There's a famous story about Samuel Johnson. We talked about him before, that he and his biographer, Boswell, were talking about Berkeley. And Boswell said, "So what do you think of Berkeley saying to be is to be perceived?" And Johnson said, "Oh, it's all horseshit." That's not the word he used. Johnson and Boswell said, "But how can you possibly prove him wrong? How can you refute him?" And they were walking, and Johnson kicked a stone that was in front of them, just kicked a rock really hard. And he said, "Thus I refute him." That is, get out of here if you think this rock needs to be perceived to exist. It's a rock. And then the 20th century poet Richard Wilbur, he actually died like 4 or 5 years ago, at, I think 99, has a little poem that goes, "Kick at the rock, Sam Johnson, break your bones, but cloudy, cloudy is the stuff of stones." So even what stones are made of, they're cloudy, they're perceived. They only exist in perception. So that's the question here. The everlasting universe of things, on the one hand, the mind on the other. We get a great enjambment. The everlasting universe of things does what? Flows. What do we think of that word? Who's winning? We're going to start keeping score in this poem. Who's winning in line one? So here, let's just keep score. Things, or let's just say external. External world. Mind. Okay, can they see this? Now they can. Okay, line one. Chalk it up to who?
External world.
World. Okay. Flows.
Mind.
Why? Because cloudy is the stuff of stones, or here you would maybe say fluid is the stuff of stones, right? Fluid, trochee, or I am?
Trochee.
Yeah, just got to practice. Cloudy? All right, good. Okay, so line one, external world. Line two, at least the first word of line two, mind. Yeah.
But it also makes a claim about sort of like the direction of the interaction between the two.
Uh-huh. And
like the external world sets itself on the mind as opposed to the mind constructing it.
Okay, so maybe what we get is a point on both sides in line two, because what flows through the mind comes from outside the mind, at least according to line one, right? So the everlasting universe of things flows through the mind and rolls its rapid waves. What's the "its" there? Yeah, the universe of things rolls its rapid waves. So who's the subject of that verb rolls? Who's doing the rolling?
The things.
The everlasting universe of things rolling its rapid waves. Things don't care if they're fluid. They make themselves fluid. They roll their waves. Oh, look, there's a mind. I'm going to roll my waves right through it. So at least one point in line two for the external world. A point for the mind because it goes through the mind. But at least one point for the external world in line two. Rolls its rapid waves, now dark, now glittering, the waves are. Now reflecting gloom, now lending splendor. So the everlasting universe of things now is turning into, metaphorically, into what kind of geographical feature? We've already said it. Dark, glittering, it's flowing, it's sometimes dark, it's sometimes glittering.
River?
Yeah, it's become a river. Or it is acting like a river. So it's now dark as it goes through the mind. Why should it be dark? What's it going through?
The mind.
Yeah. Enters the skull, it's all dark. Now glittering, why?
It's gone, it's outside.
Okay, it's outside, or it's reflecting maybe something from the outside, because it glitters, but it also reflects gloom. So where's the gloom? Just think of locating the source of these either light or darkness. If it gets dark as it goes through the mind, it glitters a little bit, maybe because it's coming from outside, but it reflects gloom. If it's going through the mind, what's it reflecting? Okay, so there's a rivulet that goes through a subway tunnel, and it reflects gloom. Why is it reflecting gloom?
It's gloomy.
Because it's dark in the subway tunnel. So where is it dark now? In the mind. So the mind seems to be a place of gloom, but there's sometimes glittering that occurs in that gloom because it seems to be what waters do, a kind of reflection of almost horizontal light from outside. So stuff is glittering, you go into a dark room, but something is glittering there. It's glittering because the light coming in from the window. Right? Does everyone agree? Tell me if this is wrong. But you know, we're going to give this poem as much time as it needs. So just tell me if you disagree. Reflecting gloom, dark in the mind. So chalk up to
the mind.
If it's dark in the mind. Okay. No, I'm willing to give the point to the mind, but it seems to me that the mind is dark and empty, and one thing that happened in the universe of things is you might just not be thinking, and it's all of this stuff is flowing through the mind, but you're just going, and then it's reflecting gloom. Yeah.
I feel like that doesn't mean the mind is empty, though. It just seems like what's in it is dark.
That's what I was thinking.
Okay, dark metaphorically.
Yeah.
All right. It's like, it makes me feel grim that the everlasting universe of things is doing all this. Okay, I'm willing. All right, so a point to each side?
Yeah.
Okay, so still 3-2 for the external world. But, okay. Now lending splendor. Lending splendor. So what does that mean?
That the world is giving something to the mind.
Yeah, that the mind is just going to be indolent, dark, gloomy, uninteresting, except that the everlasting universe of things lends splendor. Okay, so point to?
External world.
All right, point to the external world. Where is it lending splendor? At this place where from secret springs the source of human thought its tribute brings of waters. So here's a river. Source means what when you're talking about rivers?
Where it starts.
Yeah. So it turns out that this metaphor stays consistent. What would a tribute of waters, what's our much more common word for that in geography classes? Think of the Missouri River. What is it flow into? Into the Mississippi. So what is it with respect to the Mississippi?
Tributary.
Yes. So you all know what tributaries are. Tributaries, do you know?
No.
You didn't know the word tributary? Okay, so the word tributary. Good, you learned something in this class. I'm so happy. We spend our lives preparing to teach and then teaching, and we're never sure if we give anyone a useful fact. And when we do, we're just so happy. So what happens is you have rivers that are running through things, and there are other rivers that will join with them. And the smaller river is always called a tributary to the larger river. You didn't know that either.
Well, no, I get it now.
Okay.
Because it's contributing to the larger
river. It's contributing to the larger river. So tributary river, it's not, oh, larger river, you are so cool, I must give you tribute. No, it just means that it's contributing water to the larger river. So when rivers join up, the name of the river that is below the place of joining is, you don't get a two or three named river. It's not like, oh, the Missouri, Mississippi, St. Lawrence. What you get is one name. It's the Mississippi that goes through New Orleans. That might be another fact I've just taught you. Two in a single day. Let's start doing facts. All right. But the smaller river that joins a bigger river adds water to the bigger river, and it's called a tributary. So I bet you're going to see this around now. Stuff like the Arno is a tributary to the Po, or something like that. It's a word that you will notice. Okay, so the source of human thought. So human thought is being compared there to a, if it's got a source?
It's a river.
Yeah. Yeah, like a river that don't know where it's going. You have any idea what that line is from? No one? Bruce Springsteen? Everybody's got a hungry heart? An interesting metaphor. Okay, this used to be a song that was completely unavoidable in the world. And now, obviously, you have been spared it. So that's great. Another fact. All right. Do people know who Bruce Springsteen is? Okay, well, if you know who he is, that's his most famous song. And if I really were angry at you, like if it would turn out you were to plagiarize, I would sing you the song as punishment. Because you don't want to hear me sing it.
I can vouch for that.
Yeah. Okay. So, the line is just like a river that don't know where it's going. I took a wrong turn and I just kept going. See? Rhymes. Wonderful. Anyhow, so the source of human thought, its tribute brings of waters. Score for whom? If the source of human thought, that means human thought is a river because it's got a source and it's bringing its tribute of waters. So it's a tributary river. So now we have two rivers, right? River number one is the everlasting universe of things flowing through the mind. The tributary river is human thought. So, to quote Humpty Dumpty in Through the Looking Glass, which is the master?
The world.
River of human thought or the world? Okay, so point to
the world.
Yeah. So the source of human thought, its tribute brings of waters with a sound but half its own. So even the sound of the river of human thought is only half its own. So human thought would be a lot less in terms of content if there weren't some way that it was echoing or combining with the sound that's coming from?
The bigger river.
The bigger river. That is the everlasting universe of things. What kind of sound? With a sound such as a feeble brook will oft assume. So the source of human thought is now being compared to this tributary river. Is it even a river? No, it's a feeble brook. So such as a feeble brook will oft assume in the wild woods, among the mountains lone, where waterfalls around it leap forever. So it's just a feeble brook in this wild woods where there are waterfalls leaping everywhere, and the brook has a little bit of a sound. So who's winning here? It's going to be even hard to keep score anymore. It's like when you play softball in high school, 7-run inning, and it's over. The other team gets to bat. So who's getting the 7-run inning here?
External world.
External world, yeah. Such as a feeble brook will oft assume in the wild woods among the mountains lone, where waterfalls around it leap forever, where woods and winds contend. So the wind, this is a little bit like upon those boughs that shake against the cold. The wind is blowing through the woods. The woods and the wind are arguing for power. The winds are trying to blow down the trees. The trees are resisting the wind. And a vast river. So there's this feeble brook and there's this vast river. And a vast river over its rocks ceaselessly bursts and raves. So that vast river bursting and raving over its rocks is?
The external world.
The external world. The everlasting universe of things. So we get our little thoughts. And then there's everything around us, overwhelmingly around us. And we get to think, oh, how beautiful. We get to be like those characters in South Park, right? Tesla. Not that Elon Musk is on anyone's mind, but. So, stanza one, this is, let's think of it as big tennis. Who wins the first set?
The external world.
External world. So, we'll now just say this will be set one. First set goes to external world. By a lot. It's like 6-1 is the score. Right? You know you win a set with 6 games. So it's like 6-1. And even when, here, I'm using this as simile, but I should do it as metaphor. Even when the mind serves, it loses most of its serves. It may have won one, it may have held service one time, but the other times that it served, it lost. The external world wins when it serves and even wins when it's receiving. So how's that for a metaphor? Yeah, I know, crappy. Okay. Stanza two. Someone want to read up to the word lie, which is the first 8 lines of stanza two. It's the middle of a sentence, but that's okay. I will call upon you unexpectedly, if you don't volunteer. 3, 2, 1, Jesse.
Thus thou, ravening afar, dark deep ravine, thou many-colored, many-voiced veil, over whose pines and crags and caverns sail, fast cloud shadows and sunbeams, awful scene, where power and likeness of the earth comes down from the ice gulfs that girth his secret throne, bursting through these dark mountains like the flame of lightning through the tempest, thou dost fly.
Great, thank you. Yeah, it's grammatically hard, and again, full of imagery and needs a little explanation. So, anyone know what a ravine is?
Yeah.
Wait, sorry, I'm sorry.
It's like a, there's like a 2 pieces of land and inside it's like a dip, and sometimes there's like water going through the ravine. It's just like a deep cut.
Yeah, it's like a canyon, or it's eventually ravines turn into canyons. So here's the ravine of the Arve River, right? And so you can picture it at Mont Blanc, huge mountain, ravines in the mountain. That's one of the things the monster jumps over in Frankenstein is a ravine that Victor can't possibly cross. But for the monster, as part of the Marvel Extended Universe, just boom, on the other side. And the river is what cuts the ravine geologically, and Shelley knew that. People were understanding, had enough understanding of geology at the time. And so the Arve River has cut this ravine, and so you have this tremendous, sublime visual that he's seeing of the river flowing through the ravine or cutting through the ravine. And the ravine is called a vale. People know what the word vale means? Yeah, that's spelled differently.
It means like kind of like obscure.
Yeah, that's actually, that word is going to come up later in the poem, but that's spelled differently. That's V-E-I-L, veil. So if you ever do it in a crossword, it's V-E-I-L, not V-A-L-E. Veil is essentially the same thing as a valley. Sometimes people talk about the veil of years. That is an older way of saying that people are getting old. They are descending into the veil of years. So it's a word that means valley. The veil then is a kind of synonym for the ravine. So thou many-colored, many-voiced veil. I think you said voiced, right, Jesse? Instead of voiced, I think you did, which is right because of the meter. So thou many-colored, many-voiced veil over whose pines and crags. So in the ravine, there are pines, there are crags, there are caverns or caves. Over them sail fast cloud shadows and sunbeams. So really spectacular picture. Awful scene where power in likeness of the Arv comes down from the ice gulfs that gird his secret throne. Who's the his there? Almost. No mention of God yet.
Power.
Yeah, so power has a throne on top of Mont Blanc. A secret throne. Where is that secret throne? In the ice. Gulfs of ice. An odd phrase. Ice gulfs. But what you can picture, maybe, is that they're gulfs. Huge places you could fall into, except that they're so piled up with ice that they surround the secret throne of power up there in the mountain where no one can ever get to it. And somehow that's where power resides. The ice gulfs that gird his secret throne, bursting through these dark mountains. So remember that it's the waters are now dark, now glittering. Now the darkness of the waters is something you can see in the landscape. So power, looking like the Arve River, comes down from the ice gulfs that gird his secret throne, bursting through these dark mountains like the flame of lightning through the tempest. So what would the flame of lightning through the tempest mean?
Oh, like the bright light of a bolt of lightning can still shine through like a big storm or whatever.
Yeah, in the midst of a tempest, there's lightning. So that's what the river is like. That's why it's sometimes glittering. So notice the parallels between the first stanza and the second. It is the river is going through the ravine, and it is bursting through these dark mountains like flame, like the flame of lightning through the tempest. Okay, so I know we're racing through this too fast, so let's slow it down a little bit. First thing to notice, what's the last word of the first stanza? Raves. Sound-wise, what does that lead to in the first line of the second stanza?
Ravine.
And? Also kind of alliteration and assonance. So we have R-A-V in raves. We have R-A-V in ravine.
Arv,
the name of the river. So raves, ravine, Arv. Those are connected. They're not connected meaningfully. That is, it's not, oh, yes, this is the huge meaning of the poem, But they're connected in the same way that Pope talks about, and the smooth verse in, anyone remember? Smoother numbers flows. Remember, soft is the strain, s is the s, when zephyr gently blows. So we go from the S to the softer Z sound. And the smooth verse, S again, in smoother numbers, smoother in the Z sounds, flows. Same word, flows. So something like that is happening here, which is the river is raving, which is kind of a metaphorical word. What does it mean for someone to be raving? What?
Like that.
Yeah, it's not, it used to mean.
Like raving mad?
Like, yes.
Like, I think that should be like high tense, like energy, like when you're raving mad, like you're just like spitting about, like, I don't know.
Yeah. So to rave is a word that, at least for us, tends to be a personification. I'm not sure that that was originally its meaning. I should actually look it up. But for us, it tends to be a personification. You talk about someone on the street raving. And if a river is raving, you're personifying the river. So we didn't look at that last point. It's still, the set is still going to go to the external world. But raves sounds a little bit like the mind is the one doing the raving. Like, if you're mad, how many people have read Catcher in the Rye? I know I keep asking this, but it's just so good. So there's one place where Holden Caulfield says that he is trying not to wake anyone up when he sneaks into his parents' apartment, remember? And he opens the closet door and all the coat hangers start sounding like madmen because it makes so much noise when the coat hangers clomp into each other. So like madmen is personifying the coat hangers. It's through a simile, so it's not quite personifying. But if you say something is mad, you mean that it is like a mad human being, or maybe a mad dog, but like a mad, like something with a mind. The mind may be off in some way, but like something with a mind. Mad River, some of you know, is a river in New Hampshire. And it's a personified river. Mad River means that the river is scary because it might be out to get you. Yeah. Oh, I thought your hand was up. No. Okay. So raves starts maybe shifting to the mind a little bit. Then, just to give you the grammar of the lines that Jesse read, thus thou ravine of Arve, that beginning of a sentence, the thus doesn't get explained till when? So the subject of the sentence is thou. What's the predicate? Yes. So it's, if you were to diagram, did you all have to diagram sentences? Is that something you do in like UWS? Yes, no? UW, yes. Do you know what diagramming sentences is? Okay, diagramming sentences is you get a complicated sentence and then you have to do a little chart where you put the subject and then subordinate clause, blah, 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 and the verb. So it's giving you the main structure, the skeleton of the sentence. When I say skeleton of the sentence, what am I using? A metaphor, good. And maybe the sentence will come to life on Halloween and say, you shouldn't have disturbed my skeleton. So that's a way of saying never diagram sentences because they can come back to haunt you. But if you were to diagram the sentence here, you would have, thus thou dost lie. So, the ravine of Arve is just like. So what does the word thus mean? It's one of those words that might be hard to define, but define it. What does thus mean?
Can you define it with, like, using another word?
Yes, how else would you define it?
Like, therefore?
Yeah.
Kind of like...
It's not quite therefore, though. I mean, we use it as... No, we use it as therefore,
as
but...
As such?
Yeah.
As a result.
You can define it by showing its role in the sentence.
Okay, thank you. When you say... isn't this interesting? I think people tend to use it a lot in writing, but there's a specific meaning that it has, which you may not be quite aware of. It literally means in this way. This is how. So how do you, you want to know how you drop a marker? Thus. See, that's a marker drop. It's like a mic drop, but not.
At the end?
What?
You say it at the end?
Like how?
You drop the marker.
And then I say thus, yeah. But when you're writing a paper and you say, thus it turns out that the 45th president was a gibbering shit gibbon. I mean, just to take, I made up that example out of nowhere. When you say, thus it turns out in that way, you're saying everything that we're saying can be paraphrased as and summarized this way, because thus means in this way, or this is equivalent to, or this is how it is. It is thus. Some people use the word thusly. Have you ever heard that word? So it's not a real word. You shouldn't use it. But thusly will, people will use the word thusly when they're using, when thus in its correct meaning is it would be appropriate. So thus thou dost lie means what I described in stanza one, that is what you, Ravine of Arv, are doing. So stanza one doesn't have to be in a poem called Mont Blanc. It could be in a poem called A Philosophical Inquiry into Whether Kant or Hume Are Correct. Which of the two is correct? And then you could say, well, you know, the everlasting universe of things flows through the mind. As Hume says, but the mind has to do certain things to it to make it make sense, as Kant says. So you can imagine that I'm sure you all did imagine, that this could be a poem about staging a debate between Hume versus Kant. Like, I'm sure that was the first thing on your mind as you were reading it. As it would be on anyone's, really. Okay. No need for it to be about a specific place. We know it is from the title, but there's no need for it. Stanza two, now we're actually at Mont Blanc. And what's he doing to the Ravine of Arv? Sorry, that's a question that, where if you know the answer, it's obvious what the question means, but if you don't, maybe not so. He's addressing it in the second person. He's talking to the ravine, and he's using you or thou. You all know thou is the singular of you, right? We don't use it anymore, except when we're talking to the big guy. But it's the singular of you. So, thus thou, Ravine of Arb, dost lie. So I just described something. I used a metaphor to describe how the everlasting universe of things flows through the mind. And had nothing to do with describing a real place. Now it's like, oh, hey, Ravine, didn't notice you there. But if you heard what I just said, you're doing the same thing as what I just described. Who's winning, world or mind, in that case, in stanza two? I'm giving a philosophical argument. We're doing philosophy. We're talking about intellectual matters. We're talking about what we can think about and what the most accurate way to think about mind's place in the world is. And, oh, hey, Ravine of Arv, you conform to the philosophical argument that I was just making. I was using a metaphor, but there you are. Isn't that cool? That here you are, a real ravine at a real mountain, and you're a really good illustration of the metaphor. So who's winning?
Mind.
You, Ravine of Arv, you're just an illustration of the metaphor. That's what the word thus is giving you. Like, main point, the everlasting universe of things flows through the mind and rolls its rapid waves. Helpful diagram, check out the Ravine of Arv. Okay, does that make sense to people? So, in set two, who wins the first game? The mind. Yeah.
What's interesting is that the more powerful description you give of the scene of nature, the more you end up sort of implicitly affirming the power of the mind because it's subordinated to it.
Okay.
It looks like you're getting the point to the nature, but in fact it actually sort of works counterintuitively.
Okay, so really good claim, really good argument, which is the more vividly you describe nature, the more credit you get for that, okay, for vividly describing nature, right? That's why poets think they're so cool, because they describe nature. Those of you who are poets, do you think you're cool? Yeah, you do. I know you do. Because they can describe nature more vividly than others, and really more vividly than nature itself. How many people know Blade Runner, the movie? So the motto of the Tyrell Corporation, which makes the androids or replicants, is more human than human. That's our motto, says Tyrell in the course of the movie. So every time you describe nature vividly, it's not nature that gets the credit, it's you that get the credit. It's like, look at that tree there, and everyone says, meh, a tree. But then you say something like, look at those boughs that shake against the cold. And people aren't saying, wow, nature is so cool and Shakespeare is nobody. What people are saying is, Shakespeare has a really good description of a tree in winter when yellow leaves or none or few do hang upon those boughs that shake against the cold. So I think that that is consonant with what Elijah is saying. So here you get this amazing description of the Ravine of Arv. But what is he trying to say? We already know. He's trying to say, thus thou dost lie. That is, all this stuff that happens in the mind, you, and this is why the score goes to, oh, I put it to the external world. I meant to put it to the mind. Why the score goes to the mind. You are a good metaphor for what happens in the mind, where a metaphor is always secondary to the thing that it's a metaphor for, right? If you say life is like a bowl of cherries, or life is a bowl of cherries, or life is a river, as Heraclitus says, and as Shelley knew, if you say life is a river, what you're saying is a river is something we can get our mind around, and now we say that's true about life itself, and the important thing is what we're saying about life. It's not that we're getting a good description of a river when we say life is a river. We're getting a good description of life. And I think that's another way of saying what Elijah was saying. So here we get this description of the river of the universe. And then Shelley says at the beginning of stanza two, that's what this river here in the Ravine of Arv, it's a good metaphor for what goes on in the mind. Yeah.
I feel like it also goes further than that. It does that thing that you talk about when poems describe themselves, and it's showing how like these seemingly like basic parts of nature are like the external things, but when the mind like sees it, it's turning it into this. Like,
yes.
Describe it in these beautiful ways.
Right. Yeah. So you see something in the external world, and the mind turns it into a metaphor for the mind. So go mind, beat state. Football chant. I know. Brandeis is undefeated since 61, so you don't chant anymore. Actually, the famous football chant is the Marxist one, go red, beat state. Get it? It's kind of a metaphor with football as the metaphor. Red equals communist, state equals capitalist ruling class. So go red, beat state. Because if you cheer Cornell, for example, you would say go red. You'd actually say go big red, but still. So what you have then is a little drama here, which is the Shelleys are there at Mont Blanc, and they see this extraordinary thing. And the first thing that happens is Shelley says, I'm totally overwhelmed. Look how the universe of things, I can feel it. It's flowing through my mind. It's overwhelming. And so he writes the first stanza. And he did write it like in the next couple of days. But the fiction here is that this is like a soliloquy. So he thinks the first stanza. And he gets to the end of the first stanza and he says, look, I took the very fact that I was overwhelmed by this landscape, didn't even mention the landscape, I turned it into a metaphor. So the mind actually has won, is what he's saying with the word thus. The word thus points to the previous stanza and says, that was a metaphor. And just by doing that, it reverses the polarities. It does a kind of martial arts move where suddenly it's the mind is winning. The very fact that the mind can describe how the external world wins so powerfully, it's the mind's power that does that. But look what happens. He wants to say, thus thou dost lie. But as soon as he starts looking at the ravine of Arve, he can't stop describing it. So it's the ravine has taken over. Thus thou, ravine of Arve, dark, deep ravine, I want to say thou dost lie, but no, thou many-colored, many-voiced veil, thou dost, no, over whose pines and crags and caverns sail fast cloud shadows and sunbeams, awful scene where power in likeness of the Arve comes down. So I'm going to try a simile, except the simile is the simile of power. It's power that comes down looking like or even metaphorizing itself into the Arve River. From the ice gulfs that gird his secret throne. He's probably thinking of the secret top of Oreb or of Sinai at the beginning of Paradise Lost. The ice gulfs that gird his secret throne. Bursting through these dark mountains like the flame of lightning through the tempest. Little simile there. But if there's a simile, then the real thing is what the simile is being compared to, or what is comparing itself to a simile. So if the power comes down, bursting through these dark mountains, like the flame of lightning through the tempest, then the real thing is power coming down. And it just looks like this thing, the flame of lightning through the tempest. Thou dost lie, and we will pick it up here, but notice how he cannot get away from describing the river. He's supposed to be subordinating the river to what it is a metaphor for, but the river is winning. it just goes on. Thou dost lie. Let's just get to the end of the sentence. Shouldn't take long, right? Thou dost lie. Thy giant brood of pines around thee, clinging children of elder time, in whose devotion the chainless winds still come and ever came to drink their odors and their mighty swinging, to hear in old and solemn harmony thine earthly rainbows stretched across a sweep of the ethereal waterfall, whose veil, V-E-I-L, robes some unsculptured image, the strange sleep which, when the voices of the desert fail, wraps all in its own deep eternity. Thy caverns echoing to the arv's commotion, a loud, lone sound no other sound can tame. Thou art pervaded with that ceaseless motion. So much for thou dost lie. Thou art the path of that unresting sound, dizzy ravine. So that's, it could be the end of the sentence. It's not quite, but it's the end of the thought. But the ravine has taken over the very thing it's simply supposed to be a metaphor for. And so maybe stanza two, which it looked like he was ahead in the polls in the first line, to use a metaphor, now suddenly it looks like, no, guess what? Mont Blanc is winning again. Okay, we will pick it up from here on Thursday. And I will send out the poems you can write about in the next half hour or so. All right, yeah.
How long should that be?
It says on the syllabus, same as the first.
Okay. Have a nice day.
You too.